Readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. This week, get ready to rock. As they age, rock legends are writing or being written about in record numbers. What is it that makes reading about these folks so fascinating? Is it the sex, the drugs, the rock and roll? Or that they played the soundtrack to massive world changes and our young lives? Whatever it is, we're getting the groove going with an amazing selection of books as we turn to page one of the book report. In Once Upon a Time, award-winning writer Ian Bell draws together the tangled strands of the many lives of Bob Dylan in all their contradictory brilliance. Readers see Dylan in his entire context, musical, historical, literary, political, and personal. Once Upon a Time is part one of an incredibly readable two-volume work. It's a biographical study of a personality that has splintered and reformed time after time in a country forever struggling to understand itself. David Thorpe narrates.
In another mood, on a different night, he would have seen the humor, but now he's tired, exhausted. After fewer than 5 years as a recording artist, he has evolved from an ingratiating impersonator, the grubby sprite echoing a sick man, the prodigy stealing the histories and songs of others, into something without obvious precedent. He has been both lauded and misconstrued, and that is funny, congratulated and conscripted. Many want to believe he is sui generis, yet universal. Fashionably subversive, but, for them at least, always reliable. And, above all, a leader. Of what? They act as if they own him, especially when he sings about freedom. They say he is wholly new, yet somehow he seems to know all about an old tradition that binds things together, the perverse tradition that obliges him to seem to break, and break decisively, with all that is purportedly traditional. Even that isn't really what's going on. This performer, this night, is still more evidence that everything comes from somewhere. Originality, says the cliché, is the ability to see afresh and hear afresh things that are familiar. In truth, the music that has baffled a jeering section of his English audience could be traced like veins beneath the skin all the way to a heartland. Sometimes he says as much. Sometimes he claims that it all adds up. Periodically, throughout his career, he will talk mysteriously of the underlying mathematical logic of his music. Here, in these monstrous blazing songs, is a progression, not necessarily progress, founded on first principles. The skinny young man with the wild hair, sharp suit and glowing eyes did not invent rock and roll, or R&B, or the blues, or the structures of popular song. The auditory hallucinations promised by an electric guitar's pickups have been explored many times before by better players. The division of labour within small bands of musicians, rhythm and lead, is a practice born of economic necessity, not revolutionary intent. On the face of it, there is nothing, barring a voice that sometimes causes eyebrows to rise, that's new about this noise. Besides, only a handful of years before these events, the smart record industry money was declaring the pop group passé, the boom ended, a flash in the pan. That might have been one reason why this ferociously ambitious performer became a singer of folk music to begin with. As the 50s became the 60s, it had seemed as though the fires of rock and roll were going out one by one. Pastiche and inanity, harmless music controlled by cynical old men, had become the residue. The word was phony. Hence the reverent fidelity currently fashionable to folk's older gods. Even for him in the beginning, old songs had been the new wave, the underground. Now a lot of people are aggrieved, even furious, because the performer has seemed to abandon, how best to put this, the musical settings appropriate to properly serious and literate songs of the folk type. Specifically, they hold that a hollow-bodied guitar derived from the Spanish original sounding into a free-standing microphone is good, honest, authentic, and true. An instrument with a solid body and embedded transducers is the howling symbol of venality, vacuousness, mere cash, and tawdry thrills. It's offensive. It sounds like a betrayal. They say he has bartered away that precious integrity. The tab runs to 30 pieces of silver, and then some. Hence the tantrum in the dark. But offensive is good for someone, and scandal is better. At this moment, that might as well be the only law in pop's little world. No record sales will be harmed in the making of a famous concert. Perhaps this is one reason why a section of the crowd have paid to be disgusted. The Bedlamites' horror has admirers too. Some people, very shallow people, actually like this new stuff.
We've just heard Once Upon a Time by Ian Bell. Tune In is the first volume of The Beatles All These Years, a highly anticipated biographical trilogy by one of the world's leading Beatles historians. Mark Lewisohn uses his unprecedented archival access and hundreds of new interviews to construct the full story of the lives and work of John, Paul, George, and Ringo. 10 years in the making, Tune In takes the Beatles from their childhoods through the final hour of 1962, when they stand on the cusp of a whole new kind of fame and celebrity. They have one hit record behind them, Love Me Do, and the next, Please Please Me, primed for release. Their first album session is booked, and America is on the horizon. This is the lesser-known Beatles story, the early years, with a spotlight on their families, their childhood, teenage years, their infatuation with American music, Liverpool, and Hamburg. We meet the group when they could still move about freely, before fame closed in and changed it all. Clive Mantle narrates.
Jim McCartney would no more let Paul skip school than allow that boy in the house, so subterfuge was vital. Afternoon sessions, 2 till 5, ended with a hurried wafting around of smoke and washing of dirty dishes, though by then they'd often written another song. "He'll get you into trouble, son," Jim warned Paul. Parents had been saying that about John Lennon since he was 5, and rightly so, because he did. But this hadn't stopped a solid gang of pals, intelligent grammar school boys as Paul McCartney was, idolising him as their leader, and what high and hysterical times he gave them in return. In 1956-7, when John was 16, he turned his gang into his group, the Quarrymen, and for a while they rode the skiffle craze, up on stage belting out rhythmic prison songs of the American South. John sang and played guitar, forever the front man. But he was, first, last, always a rocker, and his group was now charging headlong in that direction. Newspaper ads for the dances they played were already calling them rock and skiffle, though actually it was rock all the way. And later, when John, now 17 and clearly the coolest kid on the block, generously invited Paul to join them, the 15-year-old was so keen to make himself indispensable that deceiving Dad was but the flimsiest of obstacles. Paul was conscious of the age gap. To him, John was the fairground hero, the big lad riding the dodgems, a grown-up teddy boy who swore, smoked, scrapped, had sex, got drunk, and went to college, who strutted around with Elvis Presley sideburns, upturned collar, hunched shoulders, and an intimidating stare, which Paul would soon learn was born of insecurity and acute short-sightedness. Lennon radiated a life force that turned heads everywhere. He was wickedly funny and fast with it. He was abrasive, incisive, and devastatingly rude, and he was musical, literate, and beguilingly creative. whether painting, conceiving strangely comic poems, or committing cruel drawings and odd stories to the written page, he was a boy beyond convention and control, a lone ranger. He was everything his friends wanted to be, and said everything they wanted to say but wouldn't dare. John Lennon always dared. He had long dispensed with one of the taboos of childhood, befriending whoever he liked even if they were younger. One of his closest pals, Ivan Vaughan, was born the same day as Paul McCartney in June 1942, and Ivan had introduced them. Age didn't matter to John if the friend brought something interesting to the table. If anyone had a problem with the 17-year-old college student hanging around with a 15-year-old schoolboy, it was theirs alone to deal with, though if they chose to voice it near him, they were risking a thump. As for Paul, at their first meeting 6 months earlier, he'd felt too young to be John's friend, the wrong side of the cusp. He'd impressed the hell out of him, though, and now, invited in, he wasn't going to let it slip. He would be, and was, sharp, sure, and impressive enough to hold John's attention. Paul had only recently sung in a church choir, arrived home wet from scout camp, and been allowed to wear long trousers to school, but instantly such things were history. From late 1957, he grew up fast. "Once I got to know John, it all changed," he'd recall a decade later. "I went off in a completely new direction." Paul had much to offer, and John had seen it. He had a great musical talent, an instinctive and untutored gift. He played piano and was a confident and characteristic guitarist who always knew more chords than John and was much better at remembering words. At 13, before rock and roll changed his life, Paul composed two catchy piano tunes, dance band numbers like those his dad had played around Liverpool ballrooms in the 1920s with his own Jim Max band. Then, when the guitar came along in 1957, Paul was hooked.
That was a sample of Tune In by Mark Lewisohn. And before we leave the lads, James Mitchell offers up The Walrus and the Elephants, John Lennon's Years of Revolution. It's the definitive look at the New York years of the moody philosopher-musician. In late 1971, Lennon left London behind and moved to New York, eager to join a youth movement rallying for social justice and an end to the Vietnam War. He was quickly embraced by radicals and revolutionaries, hippies and yippies, at odds with the establishment. Settling in Greenwich Village, the former Beatle was soon at the front lines of the anti-war movement and supporting a range of causes. Seen as a savior by a generation in need of cultural heroes, Lennon was just as passionately hounded by a government eager to find enemies within. The FBI and White House considered Lennon a threat. A plan was devised to deport the singer prior to the election as a strategic countermeasure to preserve Nixon's 1972 presidency. Exclusive interviews include Gloria Steinem, Congressional Black Caucus co-founder Ron Dellums, Chicago 7 veteran Rennie Davis, immigration attorney Leon Wildes, and a legendary poet activist, John Sinclair, whose imprisonment for marijuana, a 10-year sentence for two joints, kicked off Lennon's American journey. The Walrus and the Elephants is a look back by those who fought the fight. Lennon was a dreamer, but he was not the only one. Stephen Hoya narrates.
In December 1971, John Lennon stood on stage to sing and speak on behalf of John Sinclair, a radical leader who was serving a 10-year prison sentence for possession of two joints of marijuana. Sinclair had been incarcerated for more than 2 years when Lennon pleaded his case. 2 days after Lennon sang "Let Him Be, Set Him Free," a state circuit court reversed a previous decision and Sinclair walked out of prison. With the nation reeling after years of political turmoil, America needed a new kind of leader. The recently turned ex-Beatle was one of the most famous and influential people on the planet. If he could get a man out of prison, what else might he do? A government eager to silence enemies asked the same question. They thought Lennon might use his considerable clout to, in their words, sway the upcoming presidential election. It would be better for some people if he just went back to England. And the Nixon administration tried to make that happen through methods legal and otherwise. So flower power didn't work, Lennon said from the stage between songs that night. So what? We start again. John Lennon felt like a newcomer to New York in the summer of 1971. He'd been to the city before, of course, but those were whirlwind Beatles visits, frantic tours where Manhattan was seen from limousines and hotel rooms. Lennon sought a lower-profile life, ironically in the very place where 7 years earlier he had launched the British invasion of English rock and everything that followed. Back then, all it took was an electric guitar, a smart grin, and yeah, yeah, yeah. But this time there were no teenage screams to drown out the music, no mobs of girls desperate for a glimpse at a Beatle. It wasn't the 60s anymore, a decade of war and assassinations, flower power and protests. Lennon was no longer one of the Fab Four, a point he made often. "Tried to shake our image just a cycling through the village," Lennon wrote in New York City, among a fresh batch of songs inspired by his new home. He and wife Yoko Ono had stayed first in Midtown's St. Regis Hotel, before settling that fall at 105 Bank Street on the west side of Greenwich Village, a space formerly occupied by drummer Joe Butler of the Lovin' Spoonful. The downtown neighborhood suited Lennon's frame of mind, a gritty yet colorful free-for-all of music, radical politics, art, and dope smoked openly on the streets, an atmosphere worthy of the finest psychedelic Sgt. Pepper vibes. The apartment was modest by New York standards, barely two rooms more functional than spacious. It was worlds apart from Tittenhurst, the English estate Lennon left behind, a home that made an ironic setting in the eyes of more than a few critics of the Imagine promotional film, Imagine No Possessions. Lennon was apparently embarrassed by his wealth, among other byproducts of Beatlemania. He told authors Peter McCabe and Robert Schoenfield, who that summer had been researching a book on the Beatles' breakup, Apple to the Core, "I can't really go on the road and take a lot more money. What am I going to do with it? I've got all the bread I need." It wasn't a random thought. He'd recently discussed the Imagine lyrics with Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker. "I began to think, I don't want that big house we built for ourselves in England," Lennon acknowledged. "I don't want the bother of owning all those big houses and big cars. It's clogging my mind just to think about what amount of gear I have in England, all my books and possessions, walls full of books I've collected."
That was The Walrus and the Elephants by James Mitchell. David N. Meyer has written the definitive biography of an iconic group who changed the way we listened and danced, the Bee Gees. The group sold 250 million records over their 40-year career. David is also the author of the biography of singer-songwriter Graham Parsons, 20,000 Roads, The Ballad of Graham Parsons and His Cosmic American Music. The LA Times chose the book as one of the 20 best nonfiction books of the year, and Rolling Stone named it one of the 5 best books of the year. David has taught cinema studies at the New School in Manhattan for the last 14 years. He's written on film and music for Entertainment Weekly, The New York Times, and Wired. His other books include The 100 Best Films to Rent You've Never Heard Of and A Girl and a Gun, The Complete Guide to Film Noir on Video. Welcome, David, and thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
Thank you for having me.
Readers, I want to share that even if you aren't a mega Bee Gees fan, you should pick up this book because the writing is so fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, why, after your work on Graham Parsons, did you select the Bee Gees as your next project?
Well, there are two reasons. One is they're my agent's favorite band. And the other is that I felt that they were underreported, that nobody really knew anything about them, that they were one of the biggest acts in the world, which people forget, and no one knew a thing about them.
Right. And I wanted to also ask you, because you absolutely let the readers know that the band has never been given their proper due. Why is that?
Well, I think there's only two schools of thought on the Bee Gees, and one is genial contempt, and one is absolutely berserk fan zombiedom.
That's me.
And there's no middle ground. And I don't think people recognize what an amazing songwriter Barry is. I don't think they recognize how progressive they were in the studio and how many great songs they put out. They're regarded as cartoons now. And it's true, they presented themselves as cartoons, so it's their own fault. But the music and the family dynamics warranted a deeper inquiry.
Yeah, tell us more about their father, Hugh.
Well, Hugh was a guy who could never do anything right and could never make a penny. And the three boys were supporting their families from their early teendom, singing on the streets. And he was their manager in Australia and managed their career. And then as soon as they hit it big, he stepped out of the way. He was, as I say in the book, he's maybe the least abusive child managing parent in the history of child managing parents. But the family has always been very, very tight. And he and his wife always lived with one of their adult children.
I never knew about the sister, Leslie. What is she doing now? Is she still around?
Yes, she has a normal life in Australia, which is what she always wanted.
Huh. Okay, Barry and twin brothers Robin and Maurice were harmonizing almost before they could walk. Tell us about their earliest musical offerings.
They started singing at a child's lip-syncing contest, and the myth goes that they broke the record they brought to lip-sync to and then sang live. And they always had harmony from their earliest ages. They never had to think about it. They never had to plan it. They just knew how to sing together.
You know, I was kind of blown away by the fact that the Bee Gees doesn't stand for Brothers Gibb.
I know, I didn't know that either until I started the book. It stands for the name of the two guys who managed them when they were teenagers, who hired them to work at a racetrack, and both those guys' names, initials, were B.G. So they were the Bee Gees.
Who knew? You write, the boys never saw themselves as rock and rollers or folkies or as belonging to any type of music or scene. They were performers in show business, and their duty was to the audience, not themselves.
That's right. They were very much of a 50s entertainment tradition, because their father, Hugh, was of a 40s entertainment tradition. And the idea that what they were doing was in some way primal self-expression or rebellion, it never occurred to them. They were trying to turn a buck singing songs, and they were trying to make people happy.
You know, you wrote that Barry viewed his voice as an instrument, his guitar as a prop and a songwriting tool.
Yes, Barry, you know, in the disco era, starting with Jive Talking, Barry became a competent chicka chicka rhythm guitar player. But he was never an instrumentalist. He was a great composer, a great producer. He created string charts in his head. He would hum all the string charts. He had frighteningly perfect pitch. But he was not foremost a musician. He was a songwriter foremost.
Did the boys ever graduate high school, and the fact that they were really undereducated in a way gave them lifelong insecurities?
Well, they had lifelong insecurities from being born extremely poor and outcast, and they were acting out as juvenile delinquents very, very young. They never had any education, as near as I can determine, except singing and playing. And they always felt like they were on the outside looking in, and that perpetuated them being on the outside looking in. They had no idea how to get in.
Tell us about their individual personalities at the peak of their career.
Well, you know, they were known as, at the peak of the career, they were known as Pissy, Potty, and Pilly. Pissy for the English expression of getting pissed to get drunk, and that was Morris, who had terrible problems with alcohol but got clean and sober before he died. Pilly for Robin, because Robin loved amphetamines and was addicted to amphetamines for a very, very long time. And Potty for Barry, who was a big weed head. So their personalities were Barry is, was, and always the indomitable alpha. Everything had to go Barry's way. He ran things and he did it his way. Morris, who was the elder of the younger of the two twins, took on the role as the compliant middle brother who would always help out anything. And he was, until the alcohol really overtook him, one of those musicians who, if he could touch it, he could play it. And you see him on their albums credited with guitar, bass, piano, mellotron, organ, you know, whatever he could get his hands on, he could play. And Robin was like the truculent younger brother, a good songwriter, but just an astonishing vocalist and not really a musician at all. And they say that in the studio, Robin would make comments like a producer, and he would make comments for shading things. And so I think because he wanted to sing more leads and because he fancied himself a songwriter also, the whole history of the band can be written in this dynamic. Barry running things, Robin struggling against his rule, Morris seeking to find his place and not fighting with either one.
We're speaking with David N. Meyer on the Book Report.
Okay, tell us about the evolution of Saturday Night Fever.
The Bee Gees went to a recording studio in France at a chateau that Elton John had made famous earlier by calling it Honky Chateau, where he recorded his album Honky Chateau. It's a chateau, Hérouville. And they went there to record in France for tax reasons in this drafty backwater castle with a fairly crappy studio. And suddenly Stigwood shows up with this script and wants them to change their songs to be a soundtrack to this movie. They never read the script, and he described the movie to them only in the most superficial of terms, and they're all working on this dance material, and they changed the lyrics somewhat to reflect the things that he had described, and that's where it came from.
Were they there as the movie was being filmed? Did they ever meet Travolta?
I think they met Travolta during the publicity of things, but they were cutting tracks while the movie was being filmed, and there were some arguments because the director wanted to use an extended version of More Than a Woman rather than Staying Alive for the big dance sequence, and the Bee Gees would have none of it. And they were right to do it that way.
Okay, and after the film came out, how did that explosion of popularity affect them?
Well, you know, I think it really trashed their heads. Why wouldn't it? I mean, they were the biggest thing in the world for 18 months. And they sort of went about their business. They waited a tour till their next album. They kind of kept their heads down and went back in and cut another record. And whatever it was they were indulging in, their indulgences grew tremendously. They say that Morris spent $100 million on cars. Now, today, when a true collector car can cost $6 or $10 million, maybe that's not so difficult, but in the late 70s, to spend $100 million on cars is quite something.
Did they ever think in their brain that, okay, we've achieved this amazing pop success, we need to get more serious?
Well, they were very, very driven, and Barry is pretty much the most ambitious man on the planet. And they wanted to continue to make their own music, period. And then after the Spirits Having Flown tour, when they had pretty much conquered the world, they were sick of one another, they were sick of making music together, and that's when they turned their eye toward producing and writing for other artists. And Barry had this extraordinary, Barry with his brothers and with his producer, Albie Gallatin, and engineer Carl Richardson, because you don't want to say just Barry, had incredible success writing number ones for others. He wrote number ones for Diana Ross, for Dionne Warwick, for Kenny Rogers and Dolly Parton. He went in, he purpose-built these number ones, he produced their records, he changed their sounds, he resurrected all their careers.
And talk about, you know, the tragedies of many of them passing away.
Well, Andy, you know, the younger brother, he was the first person in history to have his first three songs go to number one. They were all written by Barry. And Andy never had good self-esteem, and he seeing his career as kind of Barry light was very hard on him, and he had a great appetite for cocaine. And he died of a heart attack at 30. Not of an overdose, as some people think, but as a heart condition that goes along with overindulgence in cocaine. Morris finally got sober with the help of his wife and opened a paintball studio in North Miami Beach. It's still there. He was crazy about paintball, insane for it. Has a paintball store, Commander Moe's paintball store. Still exists. And then he had a fluke medical condition, a twisted intestine, and died of a heart attack on the operating table. Robin, you know, abused himself with amphetamine pretty much forever and was very, very weak systemically and could not really fight off the cancer that killed him.
Talk about Barry and what he's doing now.
Well, in 2012, I saw what was billed as the first ever Barry Gibb solo concert at the Seminole Hard Rock. And he put on, you know, a 90-minute show that was quite something, and it was sold out. People went crazy for it. And indeed, he has been touring. He played a number of dates in Australia. He is touring England now. He's setting up to tour in America. And he's speaking more openly and honestly about his emotions, which he's never done in his whole life, and really talking about his brothers. So I think it's a new era of Barry.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker, is the portrait of one of the most talented and influential musicians of the 20th century. Throughout his life, Charlie Parker personified the tortured American artist, a revolutionary performer who used his alto saxophone to create a new music known as bebop, even as he wrestled with a drug addiction that would lead to his death at age 34. Drawing on interviews with peers, collaborators, and family members, Kansas City Lightning recreates Parker's Depression-era childhood, his early days navigating the Kansas City nightlife, and on to New York, where he began to transcend the music he'd mastered. With the wisdom of a jazz scholar, the cultural insights of an acclaimed social critic, and the narrative skill of a literary novelist, author Stanley Crouch illuminates this American master. Kevin Kennerly performs the book.
It was an adventure, always, but the miles and the fatigue were worth it. When you got out of those cars and stretched, spruced up if you had the time, sauntered into those halls, set up your instruments, fixed the wooden folding chairs in place, took out the music, tuned up, relaxed, and later unleashed the nappy-necked lightning of jazz, then you came alive in a very special way. Then glamour, grace, and audacity could ramble from your instruments. Then your mind could shine like Klondike gold. Kansas City, for these men and many others, was home base. For years, it had been a wide-open city, thanks to the power of local gangsters and the corruption of boss Tom Pendergast's regime. And in that time, the city had become a hotbed of thrilling bandstand creativity. By 1941, however, Pendergast had been fitted for a prison suit, and the vibrant glare of KC nightlife was in decline. Now the music was starting to drift away from the city, flowing west, north, and east with the musicians. These players had known no depression in Kansas City, no lack of work. Throughout the late 1920s and the 1930s, they had been free to play, compete, and party around the clock. In that boom town for jazz, motherloads of style and gushers of swing were mined and brought in, if not nightly, then with enough consistency to make way for a newly textured pressure on the rhythm, a southwestern swing that celebrated the soul, as well as the coos, the calls, the cries, and the lamentations of the flesh in pulse of time. These particular musicians, those who were sitting outside that rooming house in Des Moines, were raring to go east, to New York and the big time. But for now, they were pulling tenor saxophonist Bob Dorsey by the tail. They were reminding him, in excruciating detail, how they'd torn the pants off that Nat Towles band he was a member of, tore them off in Omaha and Lincoln. You do remember Omaha and Lincoln, don't you? Seem like I hear silence over there. Cat got your tongue? Shall we remind you? Oh, not left with a patch to cover their collective cracks? Yes. Dorsey remembered the regret and humiliation those Kansas City players had heaped upon them. That rhythm section, meathead J. Hootie McShann's piano, funky but lucky Noise's guitar, thumper Eugene Ramey's bass, and never miss a beat Gus Johnson's drums was enough to draw blood by itself. Then there were those improvised on the spot, short, repeated phrases known as riffs, jabbing like a boxer's left hand, and the sweltering combinations dealt by that alto saxophone, which had floored them for the count. That alto saxophone had been played by 21-year-old Charlie Parker, sitting out there with the rest of them, lean as a telephone wire at 127 pounds, his open face twinkling in the morning light as he laughed deeply at their ribbing. Near Parker was his running buddy, Ramey, whom he called by his middle name, Glasgow, and who was easily black enough to knock daylight out of the sky with his fist. The gutter was just beyond their feet, looking like a trench or a grave. It was a mellow morning, strangely warm. Needed nothing more than a coat or a thick sweater, Forget about a blanket or a quilt. The time moved so slowly, it seemed to have no seconds, minutes, or hours stuck to it. Someone ran to the door of the rooming house and pushed it open, making the sound of a radio audible from within the building. He was hollering about Pearl Harbor. Never heard of her. Gene Ramey remembered someone joking. The man at the door said he was serious. Something terrible was on the way. No one was sure, but the way things had been happening over the past few years, with all the goose-stepping and mass erasing, they weren't holding out much hope for world peace. I know some harbors down in Austin, Ramey countered. Maybe she's related to them. The messenger with the bad news didn't find that funny.
That was Kansas City Lightning by Stanley Crouch. If Howard Kalin had sung only one song, the Turtles' 67 number one smash hit, Happy Together, his place in rock and roll history would still be secure. But that recording, named in 1999 by BMI as one of the top 50 songs of the 20th century, with over 5 million radio plays, is only the tip of the iceberg. In Shellshocked, we get the complete portrait of Howard Kalin, who, for nearly 5 decades, has been a player in the rock and roll revolution. In addition to his years with the Turtles, Kalin was a core member of Frank Zappa's Mothers of Invention, the dynamic duo Flo and Eddie, and part of glam rock history with Mark Bolan and T-Rex. He's also given harmonies to everyone from John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and Alice Cooper, to the Ramones and Duran Duran, just to name a few. His life has been a dangerous ride, and in Shellshocked, he names names and shares tales of sex, drugs, and creative excess. The author performs the book that is a candid story of rock and roll insanity.
I was snorting coke on Abraham Lincoln's desk in the White House. Yes, that Abraham Lincoln in that White House. A bunch of hairy peacenik dopers from California, though we were, it seems that Trisha Nixon, daughter of Tricky Dick himself, was a fan of the Turtles and requested our presence. Our first instinct, you gotta be kidding. No way in hell. Yet here we were, our noses vacuuming lines off the surface of Honest Abe's very own workspace. We had gone through several managers during the past 5 years and had been on the charts far more often than anyone would have ever guessed, considering that we were the only ones looking out for us and that White Whale Records wasn't much of a label. There had been the folk rock years, and we had been lucky enough to score a few big hits. We were among the earliest children of Bob Dylan, putting our cover version of his tune It Ain't Me, Babe, into the top 10. Then we had become the good time music boys, influenced by the Lovin' Spoonful, and determined not to protest anything. We'd made it to number one with a song that's still recognized today as one of the classic rock and roll love songs of all time, Happy Together Indeed. And now, finally, we had engineered our own success with Eleanor, our first self-penned top 10 record, and You Showed Me, which we had changed from a Beatlesque rocker into a lush ballad. We were lucky, and we knew it. Of course, now we had the big-time management to prove it. Gone were the friends of friends. We'd realized that we really weren't in any position to manage ourselves. And hello to the new superstar management team. We had been courted, successfully, by Ron de Blasio and Jeff Wald, who were at the time top reps for the Campbell Silver Cosby Corporation. That's right, Bill Cosby. Mr. Pudding Pops. Fat freaking Albert. Bill, his own self, was a full partner in the firm that represented him. And us. And others. And his sweaters. And he was the number one comic in America. Across the hall was the office of the appropriately named Artie Mogul, who ran the in-house record company Tetragrammaton, home to Deep Purple, and more. Of course, he had nothing to do with us. Neither did Mr. Cosby, but his name promised to open a lot of doors in Hollywood, and that was exactly what we needed. But what, I asked, could these guys bring to the table for a band that had been around the block and hypothetically overstayed their welcome? We didn't have to wait long to find out. We had heard through the grapevine that the Turtles were Trisha's favorite band, and we'd all had a good chuckle over that. Old man Nixon was the creepiest dick of his generation, the least popular president among the under-30 crowd that had ever been, and a killer of our young men and women as far as we were concerned. We were deeply anti-war and deeply self-conscious. We weren't Nixonites, that's for sure. We were everything he stood against. So when the hand-engraved invitation to perform at Trisha Nixon's coming-out party arrived at the Cosby office, we were none too thrilled. In fact, we flat-out refused to play. They started to freak out. What do you mean you refuse to play? Who the hell do you think you are? This isn't a political thing. It's like a royal proclamation, you idiots. You play the White House because you're an American. Blah, blah, blah. They shamed us into it. Not only that, but to add insult to injury, management now was requesting that we each go out and buy a classy new suit. Can't play for the president looking like the sewer rats that you really are. Perfect. There it was again. Too bad Johnny Barbeta wasn't the drummer in the band anymore. He'd have loved the sight of us clumsily trying on the very Brioni suits that he had been trying to get us to wear for 3.5 years. Now we each had bought one. Talk about fish out of water. Came the big day, May 10th, 1969. We flew into Washington, D.C. on the taxpayer's dollar. There, we were met by 5 separate cars, each with a driver, all flying the American flag and taken directly to the White House. Once there, we discovered that the Secret Service had dossiers on each of us. They kept us in a holding lounge while going through our intimate details individually. After we had all been cleared, it was time to unload the equipment that we had brought with us all the way from L.A. But we didn't do the unloading. Instead, the Secret Service guys did. And they didn't know the first thing about large equipment cases. So as they began to unload the trap case, the large case that holds the snare drum, percussion goodies, and miscellaneous items from the drum set, they tipped it to one side and unknowingly triggered the tiny switch on the electric metronome tuner that we always carried with us. Tick, 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 out came the guns.
We've just heard Shell Shocked by Howard Kalin with Jeff Tamergan. If you were a fan of popular music in the 60s and early 70s, you were a fan of The Wrecking Crew, whether you knew it or not. The Book Report thinks you'll love Kent Hartman's The Wrecking Crew, the inside story of rock and roll's best-kept secret, and Audie Award winner for History in 2013. On hit record after hit record, by everyone from the Byrds, the Beach Boys, the Monkees, the Grassroots, the Fifth Dimension, Sonny and Cher, and Simon and Garfunkel, this collection of West Coast studio musicians from diverse backgrounds established themselves as the driving sound of pop music. Industry insider Kent Hartman tells the definitive story of the musicians who forged a reputation throughout the business as the secret weapons behind top recording stars. Mining invaluable interviews, the author follows the careers of such session masters as drummer Hal Blaine and keyboardist Larry Nechtel, as well as trailblazing bassist Carole Kaye. Wrecking Crew members forged careers in their own right, including Glenn Campbell and Leon Russell. Hartman also takes readers inside the studio for legendary sessions that gave us Bridge Over Troubled Water and the rock classic Layla, which Wrecking Crew drummer Jim Gordon co-wrote with Eric Clapton for Derek and the Dominoes. Dan John Miller narrates.
Here I was, a guy actually working in the industry, someone who prided himself on knowing a fair amount about who played what on which songs, and I clearly didn't know the tenth of it. It got me to thinking. If I was so woefully unaware of this stealth-like group of crackerjack players who routinely took the place of the real band members on one chart-topping song after another, then maybe others out there were equally in the dark. But with life being life, my discovery somehow managed to fade into the fusty recesses of my mind for almost another 10 years. Teaching marketing in a couple of universities, producing a daily syndicated radio feature about classic comedians, and working with various musicians and record labels all seemed to take precedence. Finally, though, I decided that the tale of these great musicians had to be told. Having started doing some freelance writing for a couple of local newspapers, I thought that the story might make an interesting magazine article. So I emailed a pitch letter to Richard Snow, the then editor-in-chief of American Heritage magazine. Remarkably, within hours I had my reply. He had always wondered about this very subject and would be delighted to offer me a contract to write a feature piece about these mysterious sidemen. After the article came out to a positive reception in 2007, including a mention in the New York Times, it became clear to me that the uniqueness of the Wrecking Crew's story, especially regarding what really happened behind those closed studio doors, would make an even better book. There was just so much more to tell. One fantastic literary agent, editor, and publisher later, that book now exists, and there are a few important points to make regarding the contents. First, about the name. The Wrecking Crew's moniker is undeniably the creation of the drummer Hal Blaine, who, by virtually unanimous agreement, sat front and center as the unofficial dean of the whole bunch. His skills, charisma, and sense of humor were mentioned to me time and again by almost everyone I interviewed, from producers to stars to fellow players, as being the cornerstone of much of what went on during the countless number of recording dates. If you didn't have Hal, you wanted to get Hal. In the early 60s, as Blaine and the other young t-shirt and blue jean-clad session musicians began their ascent in the business, some of the older, more established coat and tie-wearing musicians became resentful. They felt that this new breed of rock and roll playing studio hand was going to somehow wreck the business. It was hard to tell which they hated more, the lack of a dress code or the burgeoning style of music. Maybe it was just a matter of professional jealousy over getting aced out by their more youthful, hipper counterparts, or more likely, some combination thereof. In any event, the old guard was headed the way of the Victrola, and they knew it. The Wrecking Crew had become the coveted new set of hired guns in town. Now, as to exactly when people started becoming aware of the Wrecking Crew's name, it is hard to say. Some of the studio musicians I interviewed swear they heard it applied to themselves as early as 1963. Others say it was later. One says it was never used at all. Nevertheless, over the decades, the Wrecking Crew's name has become culturally ingrained, so much so that it is now universally used to refer to these great players. Not one person I interviewed ever wondered whom I was talking about. Like Woodstock and Watergate, the term is now a permanent part of our historical lexicon. As proof, no less an institution than the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame made a point of using the Wrecking Crew name when inducting Hal Blaine, Steve Douglas, and Earl Palmer into their ranks, under the Sidemen category, a number of years ago. That's plenty good enough for me. In doing research for this book, and for the article before it, I conducted several hundred hours of taped interviews over a multi-year period with virtually anybody I could find who had been in the Wrecking Crew or had been associated with them. The vast majority of the anecdotes within this book came to me firsthand or were told to me by someone who knew the players. Dialogue was taken directly from the tapes. It is of the utmost importance to me to be true to the joyous and sometimes tragic journeys of these marvelous musicians.
We've just heard The Wrecking Crew by Kent Hartman. Morrissey's autobiography is a rock memoir that cranked up volumes of attention recently. Now, mind you, not all of it was positive, but reviewers believe no fan could be disappointed by a book so perfectly representative of the man himself. Stephen Patrick Morrissey rose to prominence in the 80s as a lyricist and vocalist of the band The Smiths. The band was extremely successful in the UK. When they broke up in 87, Morrissey began a solo career, making the top 10 of the UK singles charts on 10 occasions. His first solo album, 1988's Viva Hate, entered the UK albums chart at number 1. He's widely regarded as an important innovator in the indie music scene. His lyrics have been described as dramatic, bleak, funny vignettes about doomed relationships, lonely nightclubs, the burden of the past, and the prison of the home. Morrissey, who narrates, can be vengeful, pompous, and breathtakingly vicious, yet also lyrical, generous, surprisingly self-aware, and consistently hilarious. Let's listen.
The following day, we are set to move on to New Jersey, although offhand I have no idea why. Jeff tells me that he will not be coming the rest of the way with us, as if this might make any difference. His investment secured by the signatures on the contract, Jeff is not quite interested enough to endure a second American gig. I am then led across the hallway to where Mike has his room, and there he sits upright in bed, a mass of large red sores covering his face and upper body. It is explained to me that Mike had shared his bed last night, and that the unlucky dalliance left him with an outbreak of Lebanese warts. This now means that our trips to New Jersey and Boston must be scrapped, yet we cannot leave the country until the infected body is able to travel. I pass several more days in New York by myself. Johnny is nowhere to be seen, and I do not lay eyes on him once during my entire stay at the Algonquin. I am baffled, or mentally deficient, or both. But certainly I am deliberately cut off from everyone, as a prearranged plot kicks into full gear. I am being frozen out. It is a difficult week of rigid iceberg weather, as I dig despairingly at the Strand bookshop and cough my way through the cheap eateries of Times Square slime, and I now fully realize that the other three Smiths are taking great steps to oust me. Why, I do not know. New York has not yet been daubed with new world flash and brightness. No sign as yet of the computer age, and here in the wrong section of Fifth Avenue, it is still the quagmire of midnight cowboys and sterile cuckoos. Perhaps it is the best of times for New York City. I am never troubled or approached as I sit alone in Washington Square. Smells abound unique to this city, and a warring settlement moves too fast, and the lonely traveller is engulfed. When we all finally meet at the airport, there is enough silence to indicate the end. As we separate in Manchester, fatality shrieks. Behind my back, Joe Moss has coerced Johnny, Andy, and Mike into axing the singer, and Joe carts all three buffos off to a legal firm in order to sharpen the blade against the Morrissey monolith. Since Joe himself has ridden himself out of the picture, he has no wish to see the little tugboat sail on, and the Morrissey monsoon must go. For a while, the other three agree with him. It takes Johnny a few weeks to lance the views of others out of his system, and he then calls me. Hanging by a thread, we resume, deloused of Joe Moss. May 5th, 1984 is departure date for a European tour, and at the airport in Manchester, I see Diana Dawes dead, shrieking from the front page of the Sun newspaper. "Oh my Diana," headlines the Daily Star, and the Daily Mirror keeps alliteration alive with "Diana Dawes dies." Although the press had always raced to name Diana Dawes as a nationally corrupting influence, because she was happy and a free spirit, by her death she has won them over. Death, evidently, has its uses. The European tour is a success, although there are no band wages to be had at its close. We are we again. Evidently, Joe Moss's lead singer wasn't something that Johnny, Andy, or Mike thought helpful. On a flight to Finland, I plonk a headset onto Martha Defoe's ears so that she will hear Death by Klaus Nomi. And whilst listening intently, she bursts into tears. As Martha sobs, I do too, and I run into the toilet to avoid the embarrassment of appearing too human. Engineer Stephen Street had worked on the unkillable Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, and admirably so. He was shy and receptive, and three thoughts ahead of every situation, technically masterful and very patient. I suggest that we make the second album not with John Porter, but with Stephen alone, and that we fill in all the artistic bits ourselves. At once, all band members disagreed, and only I give the Stephen Street vote. Johnny's affectionate closeness to John Porter had finally clicked beyond price with How Soon Is Now, and so dazed had I been that I ran from the studio with a final mix and jumped into a black cab, piling out at Collier Street, where I took the stairs five at a time and powered into Jeff's office. Jeff swivels in a large chair and I balance on a footstool as the song plays. How Soon Is Now struck me as a new landmark. But once the track had ended, Jeff broke the silence. "What is Johnny doing?" he said. "That is just noise." The Collier Street clouds lowered, and How Soon Is Now resigned itself to B-side status.
That was Morrissey, Autobiography. Readers, some of these artists rock the house, others rock the world. I think you'll agree these biographies are lyrical snapshots of a time in our lives. For more on arts, cultural history, or maybe just a rock and murder mystery, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks for joining me, and let's meet again next week on The Book Report.